This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Alm. The race for governor is heating up. Terry Branstad and Chet Culver are starting to campaign, but two outsiders may have a significant impact on the race. Jonathan Narcisse and Bob Vanderplaats may be candidates on the side, or at least affect the race. Also, around the country, candidates are finding the only issue to mention in campaigns are jobs, jobs, and jobs. Will that be the case in Iowa, and who does that favor? Unemployment benefits ran out, Congress went on recess without extending them, and there'll be political implications for that as well. It's Politics Day. We'll talk about those topics with Jason Clayworth, Des Moines Register State House correspondent, and Arnie Arneson, New Hampshire-based political analyst. We'll also take your phone calls and emails. Politics Day on Talk of Iowa, coming up after this check of news from NPR and Iowa Public Radio. This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Aul. All across the country, primary campaigns saw significant impact from outsider candidates and fringe ideologies taking hold and beating out the mainstream. It appeared Iowa did not have such a fate, but now Democrat Jonathan Narcisse says he will run for governor as an independent, and Republican Bob Vanderplaats hasn't ruled out an independent run. All of this happens as candidates for office seem to be focused on only one thing, jobs. Are we headed to a one-issue election? And unemployment benefits are running out for many across the nation as Congress went on vacation without extending them. Was that a financially prudent move or political suicide? It's Politics Day on Talk of Iowa. We'll talk about those issues with our guests, Jason Clayworth, State House correspondent for the Des Moines Register, who's in our Des Moines studios. Good morning, Jason.
Good morning, Jonathan.
And Arnie Arneson, a political analyst that is on the line from New Hampshire. Good morning, Arnie.
Good morning from hot New Hampshire.
It's pretty humid here in Iowa, too, although you definitely have a speed on heat.
I think so.
We'll also take your comments and questions. You can call us at 866-780-9100. Send us an email at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org, or you can reach us on Twitter at IPRTalk. Jason, we'll start with you. Do you think Jonathan Narcisse and Bob Vanderplaats will have a significant impact on the race between Chet Culver and Terry Branstad?
It's yet to be seen, of course, but definitely those are great concerns for many in both parties. You have potentially an independent run from Bob Vanderplaats, who won, you know, roughly 41% of the votes during the Republican primary in June, and 24 of Iowa's 99 counties. It's pretty significant.
Do you think Vanderplaats will run?
You know, I'm hearing from my sources that it's unlikely, but we're also hearing from other folks that they think that it's a good possibility. So nobody knows for sure at this point. It is a possibility. We're seeing Kim Reynolds, the lieutenant governor selection on the Republican side, is campaigning quite aggressively in the counties where Vanderplaats did very well. They're obviously taking this very seriously, and you know, the concern shows that they're out there and they're doing their work.
With both Narcisse and Vanderplaats, how much do you think is it legitimately that they think they have a chance to win, and how much is it that they're just jockeying for a position and they're looking for Culver and Branstad to offer them something to get out of the race?
You know, I'm not obviously in the minds of those folks, but I think that that there is some real feeling that they have a chance, and that's why that at least in Mr. Vanderplaats's part that he's considering this with Jonathan Narcisse. I believe that he sincerely believes that he can win as well, and so I think that it is a sincere effort on both of their parts. Whether or not it's likely that they could take enough votes to win is you know, in the big question.
Jonathan?
Yes.
As I'm listening to this, I think we are living in interesting times, and definitely there is something in the water, because I just got a packet from an individual who has sent me a plan for New Hampshire, candidates for undeclared voters. And what he just sent me was that there are more unregistered, there are more registered undeclared voters in New Hampshire. Many people are disappointed, and the word disappointment and polarized from the Republican and Democratic Party. 2010 is a non-presidential year. If there is a year to really attract voters outside the typical partisan politics, his point was this is the year to do it. So what you are seeing in Iowa, I am actually literally looking at a packet of information about some guy who wants to make the exact same pitch here. And to be honest with you, I totally understand this sort of tremendous sense of dissatisfaction with whatever a Republican stands for and with whatever a Democrat stands for.
Well,
and I think people are trying to figure out where does that send them, and it's not necessarily to another party, but it could be to another independent contractor.
Arnie's right on target. I mean, who is going to win this race will be dependent largely upon those that are independent voters here in Iowa, not Democrats, not Republicans. And so, you know, these gentlemen obviously hope to tap into that dissatisfaction that we're seeing.
Arnie, in the history of American politics, though, do we have many times when a non-mainstream candidate did much in the race other than play the spoiler role?
Well, you know, but the spoiler role is so delicious. Let me introduce you to Ralph Nader, who got 7% of the vote in New Hampshire. And you can point to, you know, the President Bush that we have today. You can talk to Ross Perot, who explains Bill Clinton twice, you know, and the power of that candidate isn't just about being a spoiler. Sometimes the power of that candidate is that that candidate changes the conversation. Ross Perot changed Bill Clinton. I mean, with his little pie charts and his numbers about the deficit and yada, 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 Bill Clinton was going to give everyone tax cuts. Suddenly he raised taxes and addressed the deficit. Why? Not because it was of his own initiative. It was because of that third-party candidate. It doesn't happen often, but it definitely is the most frightening thing for mainstream candidates, because they really do change the dynamic. And here you thought you were worrying about your opposition. Now you have to figure out where that third-party candidate is going to take from, which side of your hide. Your more conservative side, in the case of what Vanderplas is going to do, because I don't see Vanderplas, you know, making an appeal to moderates in the middle. I mean, I absolutely don't. What I do see him doing is making an appeal to very conservative Republicans and, frankly, people who are just disgusted. And he also becomes a none-of-the-above candidate because people are just saying, I'm not quite sure I trust, you know, the past, what Terry Brandt said, and I'm clearly dissatisfied with what Chet Culver has brought to the table.
Well, when you get to political ideology, I guess a question for both of you, do voters feel so strongly about their wing of their general ideology that they would rather go with a candidate who's on the fringe that doesn't have much of a chance of winning, at the risk of having that lead to the election of someone who's very far away from their position because they want to make the statement?
It is a tough question, but generally I would say no, just because of the long-term success that some of the independent candidates have had.
And I think it's more than just that, because first of all, you know, when you walk into the voting booth in normal times, you're not quite sure what you're wedded to, because you basically want to maintain the status quo. The economy's humming along, you're doing fine. But in a time like this, when no one is providing answers, with none of the solutions looking like they're really solving any of the problems, with the possibility of a double-dip recession, with the possibility of the BP oil gusher not stopping, with an ever-ending war in Afghanistan, with all those amazing things on your plate, people are flailing. They don't know what to believe. What they know is the partisan politics of the past hasn't delivered much. Vanderplas's problem is going to be he played that partisan card, and he lost. So is this a sore loser, or is this an independent run for governor?
Arnie,
and that's really how I think how it's going to be framed, more than he is expressing his independence. It looks more like, you know, I lost, so I'm gonna play again.
Now, you mentioned all these other things, the list of things that are going on that people may be concerned about right now. However, so far, it seems that the only message that's really resonating with voters among people on the campaign relates to jobs in the economy. Voters aren't talking about Afghanistan. They're not even talking about the BP oil well. They're talking about jobs and the economy and jobs. So when you say people are flailing, is it really coming down to that one issue?
It's always been the economy. Am I right? I mean, in the end, when you have time, you care about the environment. When you have time, you care about health care. When you don't have a job, jobs. And if you don't have a job, you know a kid who doesn't have a job. And if you have a job, your next-door neighbor just lost their job. The problem with this whole conversation is that it's so bizarre because it also represents the sort of great divide that's going on even in the White House between whether we address jobs, which a lot of people are saying they're worried about, or do we address the deficit? And sometimes those two conversations seem mutually exclusive, and I think it's also sending mixed messages to voters.
Jason, Iowa in a lot of ways has been spared some of the intense lows in the economy that states like Nevada or Michigan have faced, that not to at all downplay the number of job losses or the struggles in the economy here, but it's been much more tempered here than in other parts of the nation. What's your assessment of how big the economy and jobs will be in November?
Well, just because Iowa hasn't taken as large of a hit doesn't mean that it isn't a huge issue in this campaign. You know, Iowa's unemployment is currently around 6.8%. That's a little bit lower than the national level, of course, but it's still painful for many, many Iowans. And as Arnie mentions, everybody seems to know somebody who is unemployed, and that's a huge deal. You know, in 99, unemployment rate was roughly 2.5%. So, I mean, it is a major, major deal in this campaign, and we're going to see it come up time and time and time again.
Well, is it going to be the one issue? I mean, is, you know, Bob Vanderplas wanted same-sex marriage to be issue number one. There's a lot of people who would like other social issues to be issue number one. Is it going to be that one issue and then everything else is kind of secondary?
I think it's going to be the large issue, but for sure, I don't believe for a moment that it'll be the only issue out there. As you mentioned, the issue of same-sex marriage is a large issue for some folks. There's also a lot of concern about some of the events and things that have happened in the past year. There's been a lot of scandals that have surrounded state government, and we're seeing those come up as well. It's going to become a large issue. Those type of events are going to be brought up again and again as well.
And you know what's so interesting to me is that New Hampshire and Iowa are actually like kissing cousins here. We both did not fare as poorly as many of the other states. Our unemployment rates are almost identical, Jonathan. And yet, you know what the problem is with the economy? It feels like a disease that's spreading, okay? And you know, in the end, you cannot inoculate yourself from what seems to be a national decline. And people are worried about the unemployment numbers. Even if the unemployment numbers have not been as devastating in Iowa and New Hampshire, you ultimately know you've got to sell your product to somebody. You know, somebody has to buy that widget. Somebody has to buy that service. Somebody has to buy that ear of corn. And if people are really flailing in the other 47 states or 48 states, you are concerned.
We'll be back in just a moment on Talk of Iowa. More politics, talking about the economy and jobs. Your comments and questions as well, 866-780-9100. Email us at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Reach us on Twitter at IPRTalk. Politics Day and Talk of Iowa continues after this break on Iowa Public Radio. This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Aull. Jason Clayworth from the Des Moines Register and Arnie Arneson are our guests. We're also taking your comments, questions, and stories. You can reach us 866-780-9100, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org, or reach us on Twitter at IPRTalk. Brian from Cedar Rapids writes in, says, how independent are the candidates that are or were Republicans or Democrats from the parties that they represented of some in some form? When Brian thinks of independence, he sees a collection of the best of both parties with some ideas and principles of their own platform. He'd like your thoughts, Jason and Arnie, about just disguising the two-party system as an independent or third-party candidate. Arnie, what do you think of that?
Well, I guess my question isn't how independent are they from the party. My question is how independent are they going to be from the special interests? Now, are they running because they have a cause or they have a sense of frustration with the corruption or the lockstep of the other two parties, or are they running because they're going to be serving another master? And I think that's really what, you know, a lot of people are going to start expressing some concerns about, because they see the parties being hijacked by K Street. They feel that the lobbyists, I mean, what did I just read an article in the New York Times that the financial community is very angry with the Democrats because of the financial reform bill, that the Wall Street people were able to carve all these loopholes in, but they were just even angry that they would even suggest reform. So I'm not sure that you can be not wedded to a party, because there are certain basic ideals that most parties glom around about. I mean, you know, what's the essence of a conservative and what is the essence of a liberal? Democrats tend to be a little more liberal, conservatives tend to be, Republicans tend to be a little more conservative. Those things are still going to be attached to whoever's running. The question isn't their attachment to the party. Their question, I think, is their attachment to special interests. And that will be harder to discover until they actually either get into play or get elected.
Jason, do you think there are real independents, or are they just Democrats and Republicans that didn't get their party's nod?
I will. Iowans tend to think of themselves as independent thinkers. Independent voters is not too far of a stretch. So there are definitely independent voters. I talk with folks regularly who have voted Democrat, Republican consistently. I mean, not just one party. But for many of them, though, you will talk with folks that tend to vote one way or the other. And I think that is just a function of our system.
Let's go to the phones. Phil from Eldridge is on the line. Phil, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. A little bit back into Vanderplaats, Branstad. I don't see Vanderplaats essentially running ultimately. I think he's using this from the. He did about 40% this year. I actually heard him speak. Very conservative. I don't think he'll probably ever get 40 or 41% again. The only way Terry Branstad would actually lose this election is if Vanderplaats would run as a third-party candidate, and he'd be a pariah in the Republican Party from that point on. I might say one more thing. I'm one of those unemployed Americans out there, and the thought of Congress taking a vacation before they make a decision on whether to extend unemployment benefits is very offensive to me. So I like your comments. Thank you.
Phil, one more question before you before you leave us. The people who voted against extending unemployment benefits say that it's an issue of the federal deficit and the national debt. As someone who wants the benefits extended, how do you feel about that?
Well, I mean, the debt is a long-term issue in this country. But when you've got people that are out of work and are not paying their bills right now, you know, you can talk about these esoteric arguments about the debt in 30 years. But when you're trying to make your payments this month, it becomes pretty much irrelevant to you. And there are millions of people in that boat right now.
Phil, thanks for your call. Arnie, Phil kind of segued for us into another topic we did want to talk about. Congress went on recess without extending unemployment benefits, and it seems to be an issue between extending the benefits for the short term versus kind of taking a stand on deficit and debt issues. What's your take on that issue?
Isn't it ironic that it's the unemployed where they're going to be taking their stand? And the sad thing about this lack of ability to exercise some leadership on the unemployment benefits is, what have they been showing? There are like 4 in 5 people waiting online for jobs that basically have opened up. On top of that, we don't even have the skill sets. I was just reading an article in the Wall Street Journal where a lot of employers are complaining that folks don't have a skill set. That means that we need to be creative with unemployment benefits, but it doesn't mean we deny people unemployment benefits. If you are unemployed and there is a job open and you don't have the skills, so what? You could be from another planet. You know, you're not going to get that job, not because you don't try, but because that skill set was never available to you, and the skills you had at your old job don't exist for the new job. So I think it's foolishness. Plus, it also means that there is a direct ripple effect that really is another downward trend on the economy. Most people on unemployment, especially after the number of months they've been on, have not been able to survive on unemployment. They have tapped their resources. They have tapped their savings in order to continue to pay the mortgage, in order to continue to pay the air conditioning bill, in order to pay whatever it is that they're paying. They've already tapped those resources, so there isn't a cushion anymore, and they are financially exhausted. So the decision to do this means that there is going to be a negative ripple effect in the economy, because those people will ultimately not be able to pay their basic bills of necessity. And that means everyone, including every person in Iowa, will be impacted. Because if you can't pay your electric bill, and you can't pay your gas bill, and you can't pay your property tax bill, guess what? Someone else is going to have to make that up, and that's going to be you. It's foolishness, and I'm just, and I make one more recommendation. I want the last caller to hear me. Call your congressman now and tell them that hedge fund managers who made millions of dollars only pay 15% in income taxes on all that incredible income and wealth. Why don't you suggest to them, if they're so worried about the deficit, just raise those hedge fund managers to paying what you and I pay, between 27 and 30%, and I bet you those extended benefits could be picked up. It's ironic that it's on the back of unemployed people they suddenly notice, but hedge fund managers continue to make an incredible amount of money at 15%, and the very wealthy are back, but nobody else is.
Arnie, doesn't it come down to the very long-standing debate of more conservative people believe that the way you get out of a down economy is to cut taxes and reduce spending, and the way that more liberal people tend to think about it is to put more government money in motion. Are we just reframing that same old discussion?
No, I don't think so, because of the nature of this downturn. This feels very much like, in some ways, a variation on 1929. And you have a lot of different factors playing in here, where, you know, we have a voluntary military. Our military budget has exploded over the last couple of years. We are seeing a global economic downturn, and we're more tied globally to the financial market. We created these ridiculous packages, these derivatives and these Wall Street packages that made no sense, that totally soaked the American economy for billions and billions of dollars that we just paid out. Everything feels different, and as a result of that difference, I think you can't just look at what the conservatives say and what the liberals say. Is there a way of working on the deficit, but recognizing that in economically challenging times, we need to think differently about the unemployed? I think the concept of the undeserving unemployed is a card you don't play right now.
Jason, the unemployment benefit issue is a largely partisan issue. Iowa's delegation almost evenly split. Senators are split. Congress members 3-2. Do you think that their positions on unemployment benefits will have any impact in the fall elections, or in general, the perception Iowans have of those members of Congress?
It is politically risky not to extend unemployment benefits. From the folks that I have talked with, the Iowans, the taxpayers, they are irate that Washington took steps to bail out Wall Street, and not necessarily the individual person. So they see this a lot differently than the big bailouts that we saw earlier. And so that is a big difference in the eyes of many Iowa voters. And so I think that once Congress returns, we'll see a difference in this line of thinking, and I predict that we'll see this ultimately extended. And you know, I think this time it's still a little bit early before the November elections. Voters tend to have a short memory in some ways, and if this ultimately gets extended, I don't believe it will hurt anybody as long as it does get extended. Otherwise, if it does not, we're going to see some folks that are hurting here in Iowa that are clearly unhappy, and that will have consequences.
Oh. We'll talk about
this conversation, Jonathan.
We will keep this conversation going right after a quick check of news from NPR. More of your questions and comments as well. Call us at 866-780-9100. Email us at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Reach us on Twitter at IPR Talk. I'm Jonathan Aull. Jason Clibbert and Arnie Artisan will be back in just a moment here on Talk of Iowa. This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Aull. Our guests for Politics Day are Jason Clayworth, State House correspondent for the Des Moines Register, and Arnie Artisan, New Hampshire-based political analyst. We're also taking your questions and comments, 866-780-9100. Email us at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Twitter at IPR Talk. Talking about jobs, the economy, and its implication on politics. We're going to go to Gene in Marshalltown, who's got a comment. Gene, welcome to the show.
Thank you. My question is for Arnie. while we are scrabbling around looking for money, my question is, what happened to those super patriots who hid their money in Swiss bank accounts and paid no taxes? Because I thought that we would learn names and dollar amounts, and it just kind of faded away. And I will take my answer on the radio. Thank you.
Thanks, Jean. Arnie?
If I had that answer, I could resolve this problem, because they've been hiding their money away in the Cayman Islands and so many other places. And that's why I wanted to make the comment before. This is not about being jealous of the wealthy, but I want people to know that right now the wealth in this world, let alone in the United States, has rebounded almost to the incredible high levels of 2007. So whatever has happened to the economy generally, whatever has happened to average families, whatever has happened to the poor and the middle class, it has clearly not happened to the very wealthy, because they are back big time. But as I say this, I want to also remind you of two things. One, July 1, here's the headline from Reuters. The headline is, weak private hiring in June shows tepid U.S. recovery. And even though there was a slight uptick in private payrolls, we saw for the first time unemployment levels rising. Why? Because the temporary census jobs ended. All right? Just to let you know that that's what the job picture looks like. But this is the more important one. Our last caller before the woman who just called was talking about the fact that he's unemployed and he is incensed because members of Congress left for the holidays before voting on this. Listen to this. It turns out that for the longer-term unemployed, okay, the undeserving unemployed, as some people have called them, which makes me frustrated, the average length of unemployment is higher for the older cohort, that's 45-plus, regardless of the level of education. And this is the more surprising figure. Generally, the more education an individual has, the higher the average length of unemployment. So in the end, for the long-term unemployed, it is better to be younger and have less education. I just want you to hear this, because this is where these are people who put in their time. They had a work ethic. They've been working for years. They did everything the American dream was about. They went to school. They got more education. They got the skills they were told to get. And yet if they lose their job, not only do they have more responsibility, probably more bills, but it turns out they are on the unemployment lines longer. That's what Congress needs to hear as they decide to somehow solve the deficit problem on the back of those individuals that did everything we told them to do.
Let's take another call here. We're going to go to Danielle in Woodward. Danielle, you're on the program.
Good morning, Jonathan. Thanks for taking my call. And I'm hoping that your esteemed analysts can help me with my confusion. Why do conservatives fail to connect this war and military spending with debt and the cultural decline? We lost 3,000 people on 9/11, and that was a tragedy. But now millions are suffering from this Republican-induced recession through war spending.
Jason, Arnie, either of you want to take that?
I think it's a very tough question to answer. I think it's more of an individual politician by politician point. For the most part, Republicans generally have been more on pro-defense. We see that a little bit more. And I think that it is just a factor of some of the party politics that we see, and then also obviously individual politics.
Well, we talk about politics. Isn't also some of it just belief in what the role of government is? Because there are certainly some conservatives that believe that national defense is the highest priority, and they don't see the war as the cause for the debt because they believe national defense is the highest priority, and it's the other spending that they do not think that our priorities are the cause of the debt. Isn't that part of it as well?
So what your rationale is, security at any cost.
And some people believe that.
I understand that. So now we have to go back to the question, are we more secure? Is this making us secure? Is this a winning strategy to security? And that's a very, very important issue. I agree that I am willing to cut a check for security. What I think people disagree on, and I have a lot of Tea Party people who agree with me, Rand Paul, wherever you are, that at some point in time you have to start asking yourself, at what point do you do the cost-benefit analysis and decide that this expenditure is not making us more secure. And we have been doing, we like war. I mean, I hate to say this, it's very profitable for some people to have this constant drumbeat of war. It brings in lots of money, it brings in lots of jobs, you sell lots of weapons. Weapons are very lucrative. You and I may not purchase them, but, you know, there are countries around the world, whether it's Pakistan or India or whomever, who like to acquire them, let alone the U.S. military. But more important than the whole question of security is, let's look at the wars we cannot admit aren't working. The war on drugs. Look what's happened to our penal institutions. Look what's happening to our criminal justice institution. At some point in time, when you've been doing a war for so long, when do you ask, what's the point?
We do have, Danielle, thank you for your call. We have another, a number of calls I want to try to get to here. Let's go to Mike in Fort Dodge. Mike, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good afternoon or morning.
Your comment?
I disagree with that, them getting unemployment for 2 years, 2.5 years, when I just heard a guy the other day saying, hey, I get unemployment and I sit at home and sleep all day and have fun all night, and why work when I can get it for free, when all of us out here want to work, you know, and if you want a job, you can find one. Just, you know, get something for now and get off unemployment, you know.
Jason, Arnie, are you guys hearing what Mike's talking about?
I do hear this. I hear this comment frequently. I can tell you, though, that the folks that who are unemployed, the majority that I have spoken with are afraid. They're scared. They don't know necessarily how they're going to pay their heat this winter. They have sincere concerns. And so I think that the situation that Mike mentions is rare. I think that at least from what I see, this is a serious, serious problem for thousands and thousands of people here in Iowa, and a legitimate concern for everyone, regardless of their employment situation.
So let's start with the premise. There are cheaters. There are tax cheaters. There are unemployment cheaters. There are welfare cheaters. And there are Wall Street cheaters, okay? And what we know about the Wall Street cheaters is that we bailed them out. They knew exactly what they were doing was immoral. It probably wasn't, it was questionably legal. It didn't do basic math, but it didn't matter. Not only did we not have any of them, for the most part, do a perp walk or go to jail, but we ended up bailing them out. And as I said before, the millionaires are back. So now we're going to find the handful of unemployed people who are basically not doing what they're supposed to do. They're not aggressively looking for a job. So our answer is not to deal with them, but it's to deny everybody unemployment. My girlfriend is in Maine. She works for the unemployment office. She works for the Department of Labor. She just called me this morning. She said, are you going to be on the air today in Iowa? I said, yes. She said, let people know how frightened and suicidal the calls are getting. Okay? These are not people who don't not want to work. These are people who are terrified. And what did I just say about the longest unemployed are older and more educated? You see, it isn't the guy sitting around with a beer and eating chips. It's a guy with an MBA who's sitting around who doesn't have a job, too. So I want people to rethink what this is. It's very difficult to find work if you're wedded to a place because you have kids and a house and all those bills. It's harder to be nimble, especially when you're in your 40s.
And I think if our caller were to drive around Fort Dodge, he will see a number of vacant homes, boarded up homes, and he can see some of the consequences of this. I mean, okay. It's all over Iowa, and it's significant. And anyone that has lived here can see the heartbreak that this has caused.
Let's go to the phone. Dean is on the line. Dean, you have a comment?
Yes, I do. I actually have several comments.
Well, let's keep it to one, okay?
Well, okay, well, I want to stress on personal responsibility here. The American dream I've been hearing about people talk about here has been distorted. The American dream is not to go out, get an education, get a job, and spend in advance all you will ever earn, where if anything at all goes wrong, you're bankrupt. You're standing there begging, pleading, and crying for everyone else to pay your bill when you should reduce your bills. You should make do on what you have. If you have an MBA or whatever piece of paper you have, that doesn't mean that's the only job you can have. And then we have millions of illegal aliens in our nation sucking up some of the jobs, or I should say a lot of the jobs, Those people need to go fix their own nation. We need to fix ours. Personal responsibility does count. You cannot stand around with your hand out for a couple years expecting me to support you. I lost my job. I cut my standard of living down to hardly nothing, just barely surviving without anybody bailing me out. What happened to the American dream being self-sufficiency, standing on our own, having our rights, protecting our rights?
No one's disagreeing with self-sufficiency, caller. No one is. And let me remind you a couple of things. We've also changed our lifestyle to also accommodate business. We used to have families where the grandparents lived across the street, the aunt lived upstairs. We had these families where if something happened, you could be self-sufficient because there was a place to go, there was someone to assist you. Now we have the nuclear family. We have one person in one state, we have another part of the family in another state, so it is much more difficult to hunker down, to figure out how to, you know, harness your resources and be able to exceed. The other problem is we were just talking about what happened with Wall Street. Wall Street sold us a bill of goods, whether they sold us credit we shouldn't have gotten, whether they sold us houses we couldn't afford, whatever it was. So a lot of us got seduced. Not just poor people, but a lot of middle-class people got seduced. So between that economic failure, based on that seduction, based on how we were nimble for employers, so there isn't a family member to assist us because they're three states away, we have to then accept the consequences of this. And I think that doesn't mean that you aren't self-reliant, but it also means that there has to be a give me and a pull me. And I think that the government can be there as part of that safety net. And then what we also have to do is then figure out what is our investment in helping businesses create jobs. But jobs aren't going to be created if no one is actually paying their bills.
Dean from Sheldon, thanks for your call. Jason Iowans, we like to think of ourselves that we corner the market on self-reliance and that we're pretty good about that. Do you think Dean's comments will have any resonance among the average Iowan and especially the average Iowa voter?
Well, I think that Dean voices concern that some Iowans, many Iowans, have about folks taking advantage of the system. But I think that it also ignores one key part of this, and that is that even though many folks are willing to take a job of which that they are in which their education is well above the requirements for that job, there's still many financial hurdles that they must overcome. If you take an $8 an hour job at Walmart, and yet you have a $100,000 home loan, you're not going to be able to make that payment. You're not going to be able to feed your children, pay for health insurance. There's all kinds of things that there's consequences to that. Folks have set their lives up around a certain standard, and you know that's what we're seeing. And many of those folks are downsizing their houses. They're foreclosing. They're taking other jobs. We're seeing that. So it's not that people aren't doing it. It's just that there are some really tough consequences for those folks that have to do that, and that's what they're trying to avoid.
And I think it's also time for us to be more creative with unemployment benefits, okay? Right now what happens is you get a job, your benefits disappear. Well, that's a stupid idea because, as you just pointed out, you're not going to be able to pay any bills on $8, and you're probably not going to be able to pay many bills on unemployment. What unemployment needs to do in this economy is probably need to be creative. Work with employers about continuing to collect unemployment benefits as you learn the new job skills at the new job. Be creative. Don't just assume that someone can somehow have the faucet on and the faucet off and that will work. I think it's time to reinvent unemployment and make it a bridge to employment. The term unemployment doesn't make any sense anymore, but using it as a bridge to finding the next job, I think, is really the way to go. A number of states are being much more creative in using unemployment benefits in very, very flexible ways. I think we need to do that. It's good for employers. It's good for employees. That's the first thing. I think the second thing about unemployment is I'm also going to talk to what just happened at the G20. They just got together, and we know that Europe is saying, no, we have to address the deficit. We don't need to do more stimulus. We don't need to. And you hear the Obama administration saying, we really would like the idea of a stimulus. We're worried about a double-dip recession. We're worried about what a lack of investment will mean for jobs in the economy. Let me tell you the difference between Europe and the United States. When you lose your job in this country, what happens? You lose your benefits. I don't know about you, but I can't afford COBRA. I can't. Anyone find out what the cost of a family for COBRA is and then look at your unemployment benefits? Your entire unemployment check will probably go to pay the COBRA. So when you look at Europe, their safety net doesn't mean your kids stop going to college. Their safety net doesn't mean you stop getting health care. Their safety net doesn't mean you stop losing your preschool. In this country, you lose your job, you lose everything.
Jason, one of the things that Dean also mentioned was perception that illegal immigrants were responsible for jobs. Immigration is definitely a big issue nationally. The Republican Party is trying to figure out what their position is after Secure the Borders. Do you think this is going to have any real impact on the congressional and Senate race in Iowa in the fall, the whole issue of immigration?
Immigration is always there. It's always in the foreground of politics here in Iowa, particularly after we saw the whole Postville incident. It plays a part. We're gonna see it, particularly as the Arizona lawsuit moves forward. It's gonna come up again and again.
Let's go ahead, Ernie.
Well, let me just say one thing. Everything that you hear about immigration is true. And that is, it's good for the economy, it's bad for the economy. They take our jobs, they do the jobs. They don't pay taxes, they're actually propping up Social Security. Sadly, in some ways, all those things are true, Jonathan. They're not like one part isn't true. The challenge for us and undocumented workers is that we have been dishonest as a nation about what we need. We know we have an aging demographic. We have such a low, difficult bar to get over if you are a low-skilled worker to get into the United States. We need a lot of those worker bees, but the only way they can get into this country is to do it illegally. That's why they're in meatpacking plants. That's why they're in chicken farms. Because the only way you can get to those places is doing it illegally. We need to go back to square one and say, what is real about the needs of this country?
But
how can we let people in legally? We don't.
Arnie Dean, our caller from a little bit ago, would argue that if people with an MBA would realize that what they might have to do is sell their house, rent an apartment, drive not as fancy of a car, and take those jobs, that we wouldn't need illegal immigrants.
Well, I think he's being naive. And I think the reality is, when you realize how many millions of undocumented workers are now living in this country, and let me just take you down to New Orleans, everyone, before BP, but after Katrina, there was a T-shirt. I swear to God, I saw it with my own eyes. And the T-shirt said FEMA. Do you know what it stood for? Find Every Mexican Available. All right? That was the T-shirt in New Orleans after Katrina. So I don't know how many bankers are willing to do this, but even if every banker that lost their job or every lawyer that lost their job, there probably were not enough of them to rebuild New Orleans.
Let's go to the phone. James in Des Moines has a comment. James, welcome to the show.
Well, to me, the offshoring of jobs, production jobs, started this decline in available employment. And until the tax policy is changed, corporations are going to continue to offshore jobs. The second part of that is that in other countries, some of our salaries are obscene and they would not be allowed. And I think that we might have to return to the days of the Eisenhower administration, a Republican, when the top tax rate was effectively 90%.
James, would you be willing to pay twice as much for clothing, household goods, cars, if they were made in America as opposed to made overseas?
I wear almost nothing made in China. Almost nothing. I refuse to support the Red Chinese Army.
Do you wear stuff that's made in Malaysia or in Bangladesh? Yes,
I do. And the reason I do is because there's not much available. I wore American-made shoes and boots for most of my life, and I'm 65. I cannot find shoes made in the United States except for a work boot and a shoe. Even the Red Wing has shipped their manufacturing process to China. And if we really want to correct this lack of jobs, lack of good jobs, we need to return production. The only reason why we're not speaking German or Japanese is because our production capacity was retooled for the war machine in months, not years. And
can we talk about what we can make? Because you raise a really good point about what happened to the manufacturing sector. It just totally disappeared. I live in a state where the largest textile mills in the world were in Manchester, New Hampshire. Can you believe that? Would you believe that New Hampshire would have the largest textile mills in the world? But we did. And the operative word is did, not do. And I'm not sure we can go back to making those things. But one of the reasons I'm a crazy lady about green energy is that the reason we can make certain things by making solar, by making thermal energy, by making wind, by making whatever it is, by revolutionizing how we construct houses, those are things that we can make now, that we can make here, that will make a difference in people's lives, that will get us off the oil teat, that will make us less dependent on what happens in the rest of the world. There are things that we can and must make now that can turn manufacturing around yesterday. I'm not sure it's going to be shoes, but my question is, why aren't we doing something?
Unfortunately, that's all the time we have for this week. Arnie Arneson from New Hampshire, Jason Clayworth from the Des Moines Register, thank you both for being on the show.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese. Production assistance today from Lindsay Moon and Christoph Mai. And today we say goodbye to Christoph. He's been a great worker for us. He's returning to Germany. Christoph, thank you for your assistance for these many, many months. We will definitely miss you. Good luck in your future endeavors. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa is available at iowapublicradio.org. We can always take your comments when you email us at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by Dan Knight. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Jonathan Aull. Thanks for joining us.